Hello and welcome to another edition of Turn at a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a legend, one of the greatest front people ever, from Murphy's Law, from Cavity Creeps, from Hose for one show, it turns out, the great Jimmy G, a.k.a. Jimmy Drescher, a.k.a. Uncle Jimmy, as he says he likes to be called on this show. More on all of this in one second, but this is a good one. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is written by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. There is a Facebook page, a YouTube page, a TikTok page, an Instagram page, all for this podcast. All those can be found at Turned Out a Punk on those platforms right there. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about this podcast. Let them all know that there's this podcast that happens, hopefully twice a week, but sometimes it's just once a week with punk rock legends talking about music. And that is the way to support. You can also check out the band I play in. We are called Fucked Up. More information at fuckedup.cc. We will be going on tour with, speaking of legends, the legendary Superchunk in the end of January into February along the west coast of the United States into Canada. And we've got records and all that can be found over there at fuckedup.cc or fucked up on all those social media platforms as well. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, this is a good one. From the band Murphy's Law, Jimmy G is here. And believe me, this goes all sorts of awesome, interesting places. Jimmy used to be known, obviously, by something else, not just Jimmy G. But as he says in this episode, you know, you grow up and you move past certain things. And this episode is really about, I don't know, perspective and just awareness. Jimmy's awesome. And his level of involvement in punk, like this is someone who spent their life in hardcore and just his understanding of this scene and the way it works and everything like that. I just find he's someone I could have talked to for hours. And this one is shorter than it could have been, but you know what? Sometimes you got to have room for those part twos. Spoiler alert on that. Murphy's Law will be celebrating their 40th anniversary this Sunday, December 31st. At Kingsland Bar, or the Kingsland Bar, I assume bar, but in New York, or Brooklyn, New York, and they will be playing with the great Urban Waste, and it is going to be a fantastic show. Jimmy is, as I said off the top, one of the greatest front people to ever hold a microphone, and I will not ramble on anymore. Check out Murphy's Law on social media and also on the internet for upcoming tour dates. I think they're going over to the UK or Europe sometime soon as well. And that's it. All right. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Uncle Jimmy on Turned Out a Punk. Jimmy.
Hey.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Good afternoon. It's afternoon. Yeah, noon. Well, it's perfect time.
I normally smoke before and after the podcast, but I feel like with yourself, it's very much part of the ritual to smoke during this podcast.
Yeah. That's what you do with your friends, man. You relax and puff one and have a beer. Or if you don't party, you have a cup of tea and talk about things. But don't set your beard on fire, bro. That would be scary.
Don't worry.
I can't put you out virtually.
I'm used to the blowtorch, so I definitely I'm safe with the lighter. But I was going to say, like, last time I met you was when we played with you in the Gorilla Biscuits up here years ago. And I was straight edge then, so I feel like I robbed myself of this great opportunity that I'm having now with you. So I appreciate you doing this honor for me.
Well, I think being straight edge at a certain point in your life is a wise decision, and because I think when I started doing drugs and marijuana is a drug. When I started doing drugs, it was at a point where I should have been getting an education, and unfortunately. You reach a point in your life where you're never done learning. But there's a point in your life where you need to learn, especially, more so than when you're older, because you have less experience. And, unfortunately I was doing this in elementary school and it affected me getting an education, and it got in the way of, me focusing. I think also, you know, I think I have ADHD. I'm getting checked out for that right now, but it's a hard to focus, and smoking weed doesn't make it easy to focus, but it helps you to unfocus from the negative things in life if you're doing it right. But
I was going to say, like, I think, you know, once again, not a medical doctor in any way, shape or form, or a psychological, or have any sort of degrees, but I will say from my experience doing this podcast, many a lead singer, myself included, have ADHD. And I really do think you're like the front person's front person. So I would not be surprised if that winds up being the case.
Yeah. I'm getting checked out for it right now. Cause it's like, you know, it's got me figured out as well, never mind my whole life being what it is. Just all these memes. I'm like, hey, that's me. And it's me. And the more you look at these things online, the more the algorithm gets you, and the algorithm gets you, and they just send you more shit. And I'm like, well, I need to get checked out for this, because I think this is what's been fucking with my head. You know, and you can't on tour, I can't focus on shit. And at home, I can't focus. I'm trying to do 50 things at once, and there's too much fun to be had. And I'm trying to have fun with all the things at once. So unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I think once you understand, like, yeah, the brain chemistry, it's all about these serotonin hits that we're getting, and
dopamine and serotonin. Dopamine,
exactly.
And with ADHD, the dopamine is the big thing, getting that dopamine rush.
100%. And that's the problem with the world we live in. There's too much excitement. There's too much fun stuff. And I think for me, that's what the cannabis allows me to do, is it allows me to kind of focus it down a little bit more.
Yeah. I think the band has been my enabler, because, I've been touring and playing in the band and keeping busy with the band for so many years, going on 40 years now, 40 plus years. And, it just kept me going, and the dopamine rush going, and constantly traveling and constantly being engaged with people and new people every day, and different situations. Tour is just a constant 24 hours of engagement. And even when you try to sleep for that 4 hours, you know, even then you're tossing and turning, but you're always engaged. Your mind is always engaged with different stuff. So it's good. I think it's good. But then you get older, and with everything comes to an end. It's like when the band slows down and you're home alone, what do you do? You know, I've chosen this life, so I don't have a wife and kids to keep me busy. I have an old chihuahua who doesn't run around too much anymore. But yeah, it's like, man, I'm home. What am I going to do now? So I get this motorcycle thing going, where I'm getting into racing motorcycles, vintage Harleys. So
I really do feel like, once again, not to stereotype all lead singers, but there's like a certain psychological profile. And I mean this for us pure lead singers, there's a certain psychological profile that makes us do what we do, that makes us free to get up there and act the fool and be the MC and be the life of the party, no matter what's going on. But also, it's the worst psychological profile to be in that position. Cause like you're saying, it's kind of a Peter Pan world, where you never have to grow up. You never have to deal with anything outside of being that great life of the party for an hour and a half, 2 hours every night.
Well, unfortunately, my teachers, when I was in elementary school and junior high school, before I finally gave up and dropped out, just didn't see that I wasn't like, well, no kid is like the rest of the kids, but some kids conform and follow through. But I was always goofing off and entertaining and trying to be the focal point in the room, and also getting picked on for being different. And, you know, I think it's an educator's job to see a child when they're not in the loop with everyone else, and try to fit them into the proper niche, be it music, be it art, be it science. I just didn't get that in school. So I kind of, once I got into punk rock, I found my niche. And unfortunately, it didn't involve me going to school anymore, because I was against everything that I was being taught. Well, I didn't agree with it.
Well, and I think that's the great thing about punk rock, is that it is a place where, of all the places you could have landed, I guess, in New York at that time, from what I've, once again, I didn't live there, but what I've seen and what I've in movies and what I've kind of heard from people talking about, a lot of dangerous shit you could have landed that wouldn't have been a place.
I was in the middle of it, and at times I was it, but
yeah,
I couldn't have been in a better spot at a better time for a better music scene, in the transition of punk to hardcore punk, and now to whatever it is now, with metal being involved in it and everything else. But it's definitely evolved, and it definitely isn't dying, as some people like to say. There's new bands, new kids, and even the old bands are bringing the old kids that are now grown-ups and bringing their kids, and their kids are starting bands. So it hasn't died. It's traveled worldwide, and I was lucky to be at the cusp of it all, and be part of it, and I'm still proud to be part of it.
Yeah, like I think right now, like you're saying, it's bigger than it's ever been because there's just so, it's so, there's so many individual scenes on top of scenes and waves on top of waves, but they're all healthy and they're all.
Oh man, the shows in Europe, if you see Agnostic Front's videos, are massive. And in South America, I mean, Japan, now it used to be big for American bands to go to Japan. Now Japan has their own scene. Bands visiting places influence kids, and the kids start their own scenes where they're at, and it's just growing, and this isn't something, this isn't like a big rock star scene like Kiss played last night, whatever. It you could be in a fucking garage or a warehouse on standing on pallets or on the floor with your friends, and you have a scene. The kids show up, they support, they don't fight, they don't destroy the place, and it's still growing. I don't see it dying. Maybe for some, older bands, the scene dies away a bit for older people, and the kids don't follow that anymore because they have their own thing, and that's a good thing because it's evolving. It's not de-evolved. It's not dying. It's growing.
Yeah. No, and I think that's the best thing about punk is that at some point there's going to be a younger scene and you're going to have to concede the fact that it's not, they're going to do their own thing and it's going to be a different thing than you did. But in the same way that you were different than the scene that came before you. And obviously you're there for the first wave of this kind of happening, like the rise of hardcore and the end of the first wave of punk is I think the first time this really happens for our scene, but it continues to happen. It continues to evolve. And that's what makes it great and vibrant. And that's why there's no other scene like it because it does keep changing and keep getting better and not better, but just different and more interesting because everyone's doing their own thing. And I was thinking about this last night because I was thinking about that song, the Cavity Creep song. I've never heard the song, but I've read about it, Pain.
From my, I was in a band before Murphy's Law for a joke, called the Cavity Creeps. It was just me and my friends making a band, and we couldn't play, and we did it just because back in the day you could get into clubs by saying you were in a band. So we started a band to get into clubs for free and say we were a band. So.
But according to legend, you had this song called Pain, and during this song, everyone would line up on one side of the room and form a wall of death. And this is the first time that I can think of in music that the wall of death was ever done. But now you think about these festivals in Europe where there's thousands of kids doing the wall of death.
Yeah,
Yeah, and
we
it's
actually
like,
Murphy's Law actually has a song. We have a song called "Wall of Death," and
yeah.
that's we wrote that a long time ago. But yeah, the Pain song, I don't know if it's us or Agnostic Front, but we both did the Pain song, and it was just everyone screaming in pain. I mean, there's no we all feel pain one part in our lives, unfortunately, but definitely, the whole it was all, the whole part of venting and us finding ourselves and not being musicians by far. But being kids, having fun, and releasing anxiety and aggression and screaming, definitely you feel better after screaming,
Yeah.
and that I guess the Pain song definitely relieves pain, and the wall of death definitely causes pain, so it's like a yin yang effect.
Nicole Panter, who managed the Germs, you know, she's in the Decline of Western Civilization,
Yeah.
famously. When she was on the show, she described hardcore as being people with trauma inflicting trauma on other people and thus giving them trauma to inflict on other people. And
I
that's.
mean, on certain nights, yeah, but for the most part, it's people making each other happy and supporting each other, I feel. I mean,
Absolutely.
younger days, yeah, when Darby Crash is cutting his chest and shooting heroin, yeah, it's not like that anymore. I
No,
mean,
it.
there's a community now, and with these little boxes we got, we can communicate even better. Unfortunately, it's not always positive. And I think there's a lot easier ways to promote bands, a lot easier ways to record bands, a lot easier ways to be a positive influence with music, and it's not so much where everybody's punching each other in the face lately. So, and that's a good thing because there's too much of that going on in the world with politics and government as it is.
Well, that's the
You
thing
know,
is I've
we need to be together. That's the thing.
100%, and I feel that's what like I love. I was watching that video. It's one of my favorite videos in the whole world, and it's Psychos with you doing the Void cover. It's
That's the
so.
oldest footage, I believe, of New York hardcore music there is. Yeah. That's an A7 in the back.
Well, and the thing is, that video is timeless because that video could be taking place today in some tiny room. Like, obviously, it's godly because of when it's from. But I mean, like, that vibe of kids just having a great time, slamming into each other. No one's trying to kill each other. Everyone's just trying to have a good time. And it just,
Yeah, we're
the,
just bumping each other up a bit. But and now, if you look at these DIY shows in California, they got like a fire pit in the middle of the circle pit,
it's
and these
insane.
kids are playing in like a drainage ditch. It's fucking awesome. It's like it's still that the spirit, as cliche as it sounds, the spirit is still alive. I mean, it's just the same thing as it was when we were kids, but now through this venue of digital technology. You can promote a show, a renegade show for a Saturday night in a day, and round up 1,000 kids. You know, it's amazing.
Well, the way I normally start this podcast every episode is I ask the person how they got into punk, but I know how you got into punk, but I do want to hear it from you. But I do think it's so fascinating, like you're saying, where the technology has gone from. But your introduction to punk came through, I guess, ancient versions of the technology we're doing right now, right? CB
The
radio.
flyers, and it was like through paper, almost through like smoke signals. It was like flyers and
Wasn't it the CB radio? You hearing Doug Holland, I believe, playing. You
my
heard
phone.
Doug Holland.
Doug Holland, we were talking on CB radio,
Yeah.
the neighborhood. We had walkie-talkies, and everybody would talk to each other within a 3-block radius, and Doug would play the Sex Pistols over the CB radio. And that's how I started to get into it. And also, you got Jack Rabbit,
Even worse,
who I think
and
is.
Big Takeover.
Wow, you're great, dude. You got it. Look at this guy. Did your homework. But yeah, Jack Rabbit would write me letters on the back of flyers for upcoming shows to keep me in loop. And I had to pick and choose my battles because it was like 15 or 14, 15. And I'd go to a show and I'd definitely break my curfew. And so if I went to a show, I was punished for a month. So I was really picking when I would go to a show, it would be like, well, here I'm gonna get the shit smacked out of me by my father and be punished. But it was worth it. So, and here I am still. Now I punish myself.
Well, that's that trauma, inflicting trauma on yourself, I guess, still, because that's the, I think we're all brought to this because we need it.
Yeah, well, my father inflicted a lot of trauma on me and a lot of the kids from Lower East Side back then, in the A7 days, we didn't all come from good homes, and even the good homes that a lot of us came from, just because you live in a nice house doesn't mean what's going on in that nice house is good. So a lot of us were together as a support group, and we still are, as grown-ups now, this kind of grown-ups. But it was all kids from broken homes and abusive families, and my father was abusive through my life, and I found support through being with my friends who were going through the similar stuff as me. You know, be it a physical, mental, or sexual abuse in your home, with alcoholic parents or abused parents, and or mentally ill parents, all the above. We came from a tough set of people coming from a tough upbringing, so and made music throughout it, which is a pretty impressive feat, I think. I don't even think we knew what we didn't know what we were doing, and where it would take us.
I think that's the most incredible part about this whole thing is that it does become a place that's your chosen family. And that's still something about hardcore that it comes from, obviously you guys is one of the first hardcore scenes, but it's still something that I find survives to this day where it's a place where you can feel safe at its best. Like obviously it's not always this case, but like when it's at its best, it becomes a chosen family and becomes a place where you can channel what you've experienced into art and find celebration for that art and acceptance for that art and a place to,
Exactly.
it's so awesome. Like
And I'm going Friday with the with Agnostic Front after them with their records out for 40 years, and my band just together for 40 years, and we're all friends from A7. All those guys in that video, with them, a lot of them are going to be on stage with me, and or I'm going to be on stage with them starting Friday. And it's amazing. It's amazing, and it's a gift. Sometimes I feel like I'm cheating or something, that we're all this old, and I'm 58, and Vinny's 120, and we're still playing shows, acting the fool, and having fun, you know. And it's a gift. It's unbelievable. And for Agnostic Front, it hasn't gotten smaller. It's gotten huge, and I'm happy for them. It's amazing. It's amazing what it's grown to, and it's amazing that we still do it. And I can't thank everybody enough out there for supporting it and supporting us and paying to get into shows and buying shirts and downloading songs and everything that keeps a band running. Because whoever thinks it's not monetarily, it's not a money thing. You need money to go on tour. You need money to rent the van. You need money to get a place to sleep and for equipment. And the only way we get that is by working shit jobs and having our fans and our friends support us. And that's, it's, you know, it's a give and take. You buy a shirt, I'll sing a song.
Well, especially now where you're like a fast food combo is $20. Like it is.
Yeah. Well, try New York, dude. $40, $35 for a pizza now.
It's wild. Like it's definitely.
I'm not eating that 99 cent shit.
No, well, there's
eating the good pizza, but yeah, it's like, it's so expensive where I live right now. It's nuts. And never mind trying to get an apartment here. Apartment here, forget it. New York City, the average rent for an apartment is like $2,500 a month for a studio apartment. You're living in a closet.
When it's wild how fast it happened. It starts, I guess, on the Lower East Side, right? Like in a kind of...
Gentrification was in front of our eyes. All the buildings, you know, where my grandparents grew up, lived. They didn't grow up. They lived on Avenue D in the projects and down from where A7 was, like three, four blocks down. And... all the buildings were abandoned, and as a kid, you don't understand the logistics of things and why things are the way they are. You think the government and the city and everything should be making this not be the way it is. There shouldn't be empty places, empty apartment buildings and people sleeping on the street. That doesn't make sense. And then in the blink of an eye, all of that real estate flipped and turned into high-end real estate and there's still people sleeping on the street, unfortunately, but now there's a different class of people living in that neighborhood. It was affordable and now it's unaffordable. And now this whole city, which was blue collar people in my area in Astoria, Queens, which is right outside of the city, where everyone that worked for the rich people in the city lived. So you'd live here and go over the bridge to the city and work. Now it's completely, Brooklyn's unaffordable. All the outer boroughs are unaffordable now because super rich live in the city and rich live in the boroughs. And it's just, everyone's getting pushed out further and further. It's sad.
We realize like people without money and don't have excess money live day to day, you know, and are worried about what they're going to do.
Hand to mouth. That's well, now in this day and age. I don't see the government's not here to help you.
Well, and that's the thing. Big money, rich money. They look long term. And so they were playing the long term game.
Their money.
Yeah.
And they look out for each other.
Yeah, and they were playing the long-term game. When they were letting New York go to shit, they knew that they could eventually, this real estate, they're not going to make more of it. You will eventually be able to flip these properties for billions.
Look at the controversy in Hawaii right now with all that property just got magically toasted. Now, right away, people are trying to buy it. Yeah, for a low ball in it. Yeah, I'm always one for a conspiracy theory, and there's definitely one there. Magically, all those people's homes burned, but the rich people's homes didn't for some reason. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm just a feeble bug on a little rock. But it's like, man, it's too hard not to think. Like, wow, that's crazy. Everything burned up except for like rich people's, the mansions, and now the rich people are trying to buy everything else where everyone else lives.
Hey, go figure.
I don't know, man. Well, there's a lot of shit that we think we know that we don't know. That's probably even worse than we think it is. So.
Oh yeah. Well, and I guess we can go back to stuff that we don't, stuff that's a little more pleasant to talk about, even though it is still unpleasant. Like
that's why we light up a joint.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we got the medicine right at hand. Another thing that I'm fascinated by is that sort of like period of New York hardcore that I guess we're kind of talking about, where you have stuff that's like, you know, eventually New York hardcore gets sonically a little more defined as something, but like there's that period where you got bands like Sacrilege, and you have bands like Psychos, I guess Gilligan's Island, you know, you're a Cavity Creep, like all these sort of like pre the bands that would become the bands. It felt like it was such a cool, fertile time for punk music. Like, were you guys all interacting, playing together? Like, I know you shared everybody members of Sacrilege.
Well, I think everybody was jamming together, and even more so now, you know, with the revolving door that Murphy's Law is and has been. It's just like, you look at how many people playing Madball. It's like, Brendan and Matt Paul plays in Murphy's Law, plays in Sheer Terror. I mean, but at our age and the boomers that we are, as dickheads like to call some of us, a lot of guys grow up and they got kids, they got grandkids, they got jobs, they own businesses now, they have homes. The girls too, the women as well in the scene. have to take care of their families and that play in bands. And it's like you got to cut and slice your time. So to have a single band unit at our age is very difficult, because you're going to find one person that just bought a house or is trying to buy a house or about to get married, his wife's having a kid, or vice versa. It's like, so you need to find people to manage time. You need to keep it going. So you need a group of people that all know everybody's songs to jump in at any time.
Well, that's what, and also so. Punk and hardcore feels like you're on this island, and eventually everyone's spread out at first. And then as the island gets smaller and smaller, as you get older, you wind up realizing like, hey, there's only so many of us left. Let's start bands together. Like all the beefs that we used to have, forget about them. Cause like,
If you're still carrying beef from when you're 15 years old, you got to get serious. You got to get a life. I mean, I can't even imagine why you'd carry beef that long, unless somebody murdered your fucking sister or something. But it's like, you know, the childish things. There's many childish people still on our scene, and they shall be nameless, but I'm sure it runs through people's minds. I think also there's a lot of mental illness that's set in with people. If you see certain ramblings and rantings that go on with certain groups and certain people, I think it's just mental illness. And I think other people feed off of it and think it is a comedic thing where it's a joke. But it's also sad that some people that are were great in our scene are also just struggling mentally and find so much anger and hate towards former members of their bands or just their scene in general, and just continue to spew this diarrhea of hate and negativity when our scene's supposed to be a positive thing.
Well, you're right, because I think there's like
it's mental illness. I think a lot,
100%,
a lot of people
100%.
Flip.
No, I agree with you, because I think, yeah. And we live in there's a very complicated relationship, not just in punk, but in all of rock and roll, with mental illness, where we tend to romanticize it, and like it becomes something that becomes, well, we benefit from it too, but through this art that we get from these people. But then it's mental illness, so it is a double-edged sword, and there's eventually going to be a side of it where these people need support and need kind of like a little sensitivity.
Yeah, in a righteous way that I could name one person before I get into the talking shit mode. HR, for instance. HR was struggling with mental illness, and I don't feel he was getting much support from his interior people. And then finally it came about that he started to get support and started to get help and is showing a lot of growth and a lot of improvement, but he was struggling. HR was a very powerful, strong individual on our scene. And something set in his head, and the wheels were not turning on all fours. And he kind of was going willy nilly, and people were entertained by it when it was something very sad and somebody needed help that was in our community and finally is getting it. And I'm happy that he is finally, but I do know that he's getting these really bad headaches and stuff too. And I really feel bad that he's struggling with his health. A lot of us are, but that's what happens with age.
Yeah. And I think that's a perfect example of someone who, like, you know, I'm talking to someone who's in that category right now, but like in terms of a front person, like one of the greatest to ever hold a microphone. And the fact that he was not treated with some sort of reverence, and the fact that it became kind of a mockery at a certain point, when like it's clear that he was struggling for mental health, like even the most outside people, and he's talked about it now. So I'm not like I'm letting a cat out of the bag, but it was like that.
No. Yeah, he was like that for years. And then it was people blaming it on drugs, but he was doing drugs to cover up his mental problems. And then it just escalated, which happens to a lot of us, and myself included. And that's what this part of this scene is about. There's no normal people, period, in any community. And if you think you're normal, you really have a problem, because no one's normal. We all have our issues, and that's part of being human. It's just how you deal with it and who you surround yourself with when you're dealing with it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people that benefit from, especially when you're in a band, keeping the show on the road. And sometimes the show needs to be taken off the road.
Yeah, you find that member that can't handle that 16-hour drive, or that just can't, that has other issues that's going on at home, that once they leave home, it grows tenfold, because the mindset kicks in. I've had people lose their shit on tour, and I've lost my shit on tour. But it's when you're with people, people don't understand. It's like, why have you had so many members? I'm like, in 40 years, Who have you worked with steadily for 40 years? I mean, and slept with, and you know, you get in a vehicle to commute to work. All right, if your commute's an hour, that's a long time. Sometimes my commute to work is 16 hours or 24 hours or 10 hours in a van with everyone, you know, snoring, farting, eating whatever disgusting egg salad in the van. It's disgusting. People get on your nerves.
Yep.
And then you got to share a room with somebody. You're never really alone on tour ever.
Never.
And then you get home and it's like crickets. You know, it's not an easy life. But then again, you could also stand in front of a lot of people screaming, smiling, and having a great time and loving you. And that's an amazing feeling that not many people get. And I'm very fortunate to have had it for a good portion of my life.
Well, and also
I'm lucky.
And I think not to cut you off, but the influence you've had too, and the fact that like this is a scene that you built. You know, this is like obviously hardcore wasn't invented in New York, titularly. But like New York hardcore.
No. California was doing a lot, and so was DC and Boston.
Please, Vancouver, my friend. DOA.
DOA definitely. DOA was playing A7 as well, and I definitely learned a lot from Canada.
Well, and also, I think part of your
that was
history.
One of the first, I think that was the first country I went to. That was the first country I left America to. It's kind of easy to get in, though. Well, actually, it wasn't easy to get in back then.
No, and it's still not.
My strip search, actually.
Yeah, now it might be harder.
You know, this time it was the easiest time ever. It was so easy to get in.
I'm glad. Well, I was going to say, because I think DOA also plays a huge part in your history, because I think the first Murphy's Law appearance is against that DOA show, right? Or DOA was booked to play Irving Plaza, and you guys played another New Year's party, right?
Did your homework, yeah. And their show was really expensive. And our show was not, and it wasn't even our show. I guess I think Jesse Malin, his band Heart Attack, and I think MDC. I'm not sure who else played, but we played this place, the Plug Club, which turned into the original Green Door Parties, which turned into Coney Island High. But that was a guy, Giorgio Gromowski, and Giorgio Gromowski was the producer for the Yardbirds, and he managed the Rolling Stones, and he had this art space. I think it was 38th Street up from Billy's Topless Bar. And he had the space, and he let Jesse do parties there. And we played New Year's Eve. That was, and this is the anniversary coming up now, but that's what kind of set things off. Yeah. So it was called the Opposition Party, if I do recall, on the flyer. And it was opposing that show, because it was, that show was like $20. $20. That was a lot of money for a show.
Oh, absolutely. And I guess that's also speaks to like what we were talking about earlier. Like, in hardcore, there's always going to be like that next wave that's going to come in and be like, well, your shows are too expensive, or our bands can't play it. We're going to have our own space, and we're going to find, even though the Rolling Stones manager seems like a pretty amazing spot to have hardcore shows at.
Well, that's at the point that he was doing it and also doing the Yardbirds, and I'm not sure what else we did. But yeah, if you look him up, he's got quite a history, and I'm lucky to have called him a friend. He's not with us anymore, but he was quite the character. Amazing guy.
Go on, sorry.
And he helped. He helped it happen. So I thank him for that.
Well, that's the amazing thing about New York too, is like it feels like as much as there is like obviously class divides, that downtown New York kind of art punk, you know, street rock and roll intersection. There's a lot of like interesting characters, like Williams Burroughs being at CBGB's, or like Andy Warhol stuff, obviously prior to that, but there feels like there is like a lot of intermingling that wouldn't happen in any other city.
Absolutely. The club scene in New York back then was quite the melting pot of everybody, graffiti writers, classically trained artists, classically trained musicians, maniacs, drug addicts, drug dealers, drag queens, you name it, fashion designers, models, everybody, gangsters, the whole gambit, all in one room, having a good time, nobody shooting each other or anything, and having a great time, and turning things into collaborations and creativity, and also living together in areas. Now that this is when Soho was still a factory area. Now it's $20 million. You know, once artists make a place cool and musicians make a place cool, the rich move in and push the artists out. And then they wonder why their neighborhood's not cool anymore. Lower East Side, same thing. Artists, musicians, little clubs, everything. Rich people move in and push everybody out. And then now it's just
the places that all these people try to escape to move somewhere cool is now they just made it where they try to get away from. It's like, you know, I'm not one for a $20 cappuccino, man. And that's what they're doing in the Lower East Side right now, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it just feels like, well, I remember when more recently when Vice opened their office on the Brooklyn waterfront and it was on top of all those DIY venues that got shut down. It's like, why not just open a space in the basement of your building and say, this is a DIY venue. Like anyone can come book this space and at least foster the kind of stuff that brought you to that neighborhood.
That doesn't help the growth of capitalism. That no. they're trying to make money, not spend money. And that opening up an artist space and venue would be smart in my opinion, in your opinion. And I think that would be great for a good look for Vice, as opposed to going out and looking for things. They could go right where they're at and create mm-hmm. things and nurture stuff. And they have the money to do it, or had them. I don't know what they got, but easily could have got the Vice offices and had a creative space beneath it, which would have made Vice look a lot cooler than they think they are. Really, because it would help nurture art and music. And I don't think they think like that. I think they're thinking of selling, not spending. So they're trying to make money, not spend it.
Well, and that's the thing is, because then these companies have to spend, you know, like they're always spending money to try and get these cool things after they're there, instead of, like you're saying, fostering them. Like, not, you don't have to sponsor them, but like just give it the space instead of impeding the space for it. Like, you look at, I always talk about Sweden in the 90s when you had all this,
bring up Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. Like how big music got from Sweden. And then you talked to all these bands. There were like community centers that had full recording studios with full gear and practice spaces. And
that's all of Europe. That's your, everywhere you go in your Belgium, everywhere. And you play some of these, especially Belgium has beautiful venues mm-hmm. and it's part of arts and culture, and the mm-hmm. government helps to support it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the promoter doesn't make the nut at the door, the government takes care of the band. It's like they're supporting art, culture, and music, even foreign art, culture, and music, which helps people chill and helps people be better people, I think. And, you know, here we shut down venues. We shut down skate parks. We cut the budget on music and art classes. You know, in New York right now, we're cutting the budget on the fire department.
Yeah. I guess going back to like, what, that's why I think New York hardcore to me is so awesome and so amazing, because you can talk about DC and obviously there were money. Not everyone had money, but there was money in DC. You talk about Boston.
Yeah, a lot of kids came from people with money, sure.
Yeah, and in Boston, like, it's working class in a lot of cases, but there was means, there were stable homes that kids were coming from. But like New York,
yeah.
You know, not to stereotype, but like from my understanding, it's like homeless kids in some cases. And there's kids with
homeless means, kids sleeping in Tompkins Square Park, staying in a C squat, multiple squats, all living together in abandoned buildings, you know, and all working in nightclubs together and all struggling together yeah. And not alone. That's the problem with a lot of people that are homeless. They're alone. And, I think a lot of us wouldn't have done as well as we've done had we not had the scene that we came up on and not the support group that we've had and still have to this day. I feel for the people that have nothing, you know, that we just went past the holiday here, Thanksgiving, which has a lot of meanings to me. And it's not about pilgrims, and it's about being thankful, taking a moment to be thankful for what you have around you and in you and in your life. You know, you might be laying on the street right now, but you might have a really cool dog that you got. That's something to be thankful for. Mm-hmm. Somebody just put $5 in your cup. Something to be thankful for. You know, there's children being born right now with cancer and horrible diseases that don't even know anything. They don't know if people are black and white. They don't know. They don't know Muslim or Catholic. All they know is that they're not well. And you need to be thankful for every morning you wake up and take a deep breath and can stand up. You know, and change things, be it yourself or the world around you.
So, like,
what was in that cup of coffee?
It's the coffee and the cannabis. It's the hippie speedball, they call it, right?
Yeah, I just had quite the hippie speedball. I just got a new coffee machine. I just push a button and coffee comes out.
I heard I heard in a podcast, it might have been Hardcore Chronicles, New York Hardcore Chronicles, that you were You were going to be the drummer in Kraut at one point? Or
that was that was that was the plan. My grandfather, James Fertavante. I got a picture of him. Hang on. Give me.
Yeah.
I only have like three pictures of him. He died before I was born, and that's the picture of him right there.
Oh man.
That he made that drum kit, and he played drums, all self-taught, and I never met him. He died before I was born, so I was always intrigued by what my mother would tell me by him about him, and I wanted to be like my grandfather that I never met, because he sounded way cooler than everything else that was going on around me. And I don't have the gift of the rhythm that he did, I guess. But I do have the gift of the gab. At least I had that.
Was that before the 7-inches that you tried out for him, or was that after the singles?
Oh, that's before they did anything. This is when I was still in junior high school. And then I think awesome. I was in seventh grade. That's when Johnny Feedback blessed me with the cursed name of Gestapo, which has bit me in the ass throughout my life.
Now it's Jimmy G, just Jimmy G.
You know, it's time to grow up and know that when you got a dumb negative nickname, you need to step away from it.
I get it.
Especially in this day and age in this world, it's just a dumb nickname to have.
Well, try playing in a band called Fucked Up now, where you can't search it on the internet, you can't be on Facebook with it. It was funny.
Everything's fucked up, so you get a lot of
It's also like every algorithm thinks you're talking about something way worse than a fat guy yelling into a microphone.
Yeah, that's probably kind of tough to get that out.
Yes.
But I'm sure there's a lot of other bands you could mention that have worse names.
Way worse.
Nowhere.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm lucky that people didn't judge the book by its cover and got to know me before they judged me for my foolish nickname. It turned into a blessing more than a curse in a lot of ways, because a lot of people came to me and tried to confront me on it, and it turned out to be rather than a confrontation, a friendship. Because the name is not the person. And unfortunately, I got stuck with that name instead of Jimmy Friendship or Jimmy Nice Guy. that doesn't roll off the tongue as well, though.
No. Growing up in it, I didn't even associate it with the negative connotation of your name, because I'm like, oh, that's just who you are. And I'd always heard that you were like, as much as you had a fierce, a fearsome reputation in the mosh pit, that you were always like a really funny guy. And anytime I saw you guys live or saw video, you know, you always seemed very affable. So for me, it just seemed like a weird coincidence.
I give people back what they give to me. I could be the nicest guy in the world or the meanest son of a bitch I ever met. But yeah, if somebody's nice to me, I'm nice back. And that's how everybody should be in life. As opposed to people just being on the defensive all the time. I try to open myself up and be nice. I try to make a friend every day. If I jump out I'm going to go out on my bike a little bit. I go on my bike, go for a ride in my neighborhood. I'll try to, hey, what's up? Make a friend every day. Say hello to somebody. Be nice to somebody every day. Try to make somebody's day better. Doesn't cost you anything. Doesn't take much effort. Smile, say hello to somebody. Make somebody's day feel a little better.
One band that had a name that was used a lot in punk, but might not have been a great name to tour with back then if they had toured, was the KGB. Do you remember a band called the KGB that Vic Venom was in?
We played with KGB, yes, and GBH at the Rock Hotel.
Yeah. Yes, you did.
I think that might have been a New Year's Eve show.
Yeah, there's a flyer for it. That is Fred Armisen, yeah, the comedian. That was his band that he was the drummer in.
No way.
And I asked him about it. He has very little memories of being in the band other than that they played with you guys that one time. But I knew your memory.
Remember that.
Oh, I knew your memory would be, I could rely on this one.
Well, I worked it at the Rock Hotel, which was the Jane Street Hotel on the west side of Manhattan. And the Jane Street Hotel was a pretty, back then you could literally like rent a closet for a couple bucks a night. And it must have been a really nice hotel years ago. And it is a boutique hotel now. But it must have been a beautiful hotel back in the day. But when it was Rock Hotel, that's a good thing about punk rock. We always find a place that's struggling, and they welcome us in, that has space, and we make the best of it, turn it into a venue, and unfortunately usually those places succeed and then we get pushed out. But the Rock Hotel was that. It was a hotel that had like a theater space in it, and that's how we did shows there. And that's where that show was. But I remember, I think Uncle Al, my old guitar player, made a flyer. It said a limey Limey GBH, Commie KGB, and then it said Murphy's Law. I think that was it was a Where's the Beef flyer. It might have been. Well, I can't believe my memory. Where's the Beef was this old lady for Wendy's. I was like, Where's the Beef?
Yeah.
So we were like, Where's the Beef? Here's the Beef. And it was like, yeah, it was like a political poke at them.
That's awesome. That's too funny.
GBH are great friends of mine.
Oh, yeah. One of the, yeah, I think like one of the British bands that all the New York bands seem to love and seem to be like down with all the hardcore kids. Still to this day, they're down.
Yeah, they're family. They're, you know, when you travel, some bands travel and they don't step out from behind the backstage, or when you travel, you go out and make friends. And in 40 years or 40 plus years for them, but traveling, they've made great friends. And they're like family. You know, those guys, you know, I've known them since I'm a kid. Mm-hmm. I've known them since before I was in a band. And one of the reasons I'm in a band is because of them. So there's this whole nurturing, growing thing, and when you know people that long, you know, without any difficulties or drama, you know, it's a blessing to have people like that in your life for that long, especially when your heroes become your friends.
Was your first show the Buzzcocks? Was that the first concert you went to?
No, my first show was Doug Holland's band. He had a band, Apprehended, and they played a club here. I'm in Astoria, Queens, down the block by the projects, not such a great neighborhood still to this day. There was a beautiful Art Deco space called Exile, and like beautiful Art Deco doors and Art Deco fixtures. And then you enter the room and it's like a small, not a movie theater per se, but because it had a flat floor. Movie theaters usually have the slant, the little balcony, and they played in there. And I remember I was like, oh, and then I think that was the first taste in it. And it was a lot of girls and it was a lot of fun. And and then I went to Max's Kansas City and I saw the Stimulators, and that was it. Then I was done. That's when me and Harley became friends. And it was the beginning of a different life for me, you know, because I was like, this is what I like to do. This is what people I like to be around. And this is what I like. I like music. I like people that make music. I like people that make art and people that help music be created. You know, the whole process around it. I like all of it. Producers, engineers, artists, pressing plant people, everybody. The whole fucking thing is awesome. And all the people that make music happen and make it get out, it's awesome.
What was Max's like?
Except for the record label people. They could. Max's, when I first went to Max's had it had a downstairs that had the restaurant, which was famous. I think on the Max's sign, it said chickpeas and steak. I was a kid, so I didn't have any fucking money, so I never had the chickpeas and steak. But I remember having soup down there. But the bar downstairs with the restaurant was really cool. But by the time I was underage, so even getting in there was a challenge. And because, I mean, 13 years old.
Yeah.
You know, Harley was like 12 in there. And we were still getting beers and shit in these fucking clubs. We didn't serve at 13 years old in a club. And then even better, I'm sure much of the dismay of like the talking head people and all that genre of fancy punk, that the restaurant got closed and they made it an arcade. So that's that definitely helped the evolution of punk to hardcore, because we were all hanging out in the arcade because we were all underage kids, and then we'd go upstairs and watch the Harley play or what the fuck, trying to think of the band.
Do you ever see The Mad?
I saw, well, The Misfit. I never saw The Mad, but I was friends with Scream Mad George.
Oh, my gosh.
And George is a great guy. George,
those
is
videos are amazing of them, where he's, yeah, like disemboweling himself.
Yeah, well, he became a special effects guy.
Reanimator.
So, yeah. The son of Reanimator. And but he, that record Eyeball, the art that he did, he would do a lot of art for the early Stimulators flyers and like The Misfit. I don't know if he did The Misfits, but he did a lot of flyer art as well.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a fanzine called Damaged Goods that did a lot of really cool. The guy Donnell, I don't know if I'm branching off of his ADHD guy.
Go.
There was a guy Donnell who played in a band called The Influence from New York Hardcore that gets no respect, and they should. Nobody knows about them. They're not, you know, they're not talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, they're African American black guys, from Queens. The guy Rerun was the singer. Donnell was, I don't know if he's the bass player, it's a long time ago, but he did this amazing art. He did a lot of great early flyers of the Bad Brains and the Beastie Boys and such. But he did the art on a fanzine called Damaged Goods that was amazing. A lot of really cool art in it. Just even the font on the writing and stuff on everything was really done well. Done well by Donnell. But yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. But like Screaming Mad George, he had a lot of art and everything. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, you know, fucking people do a flyer on a computer. There's no personality in it. You could see that, you know, you go to Flyer Creator app, you know, no, it's like a lot of work went into flyers and stuff. Flyer art was a big part of the scene. So people collect them. People now, you know, it's like, another thing gone. But Donnell, the influence, if anyone could find any of that, I don't think they ever put a record out even, but I think there is recordings out there of them.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, I think I saw his, you know, kind of in the era of Instagram, of course, all this stuff's getting posted about and rediscovered a little bit more, but I think it goes to speak to how many incredible artists there were at that time, like hand style, how many people did graffiti, like how many people had, that Urban Styles book that Freddie Alva did, or Tony did, that's just fucking unbelievable. That's got like...
Yeah. A lot of guys are doing graffiti then. A lot of girls, everyone is doing graffiti then.
Yeah.
Or everybody's just writing their band's name on a wall everywhere they went, which is our own form of graffiti. The subways are fucking nuts. I mean, like floor to ceiling, interior and exterior, just graffiti. It was crazy. But everyone was doing art. Everyone was, you know, when you're a kid, you like doodling, and everybody's doodling. But some people doodle better than the others. it's like mirror. Which is Dave Parsons. It was Dave from Rat Cage.
Okay, yeah.
And he was the one who put out the first, he put out the first Bad Brains 7-inch Pay to Come, I believe. I think Jack Flanagan from The Mob did that too. And I think Dave put out the first Beastie Boy 7-inch as well.
Yeah, and Young and Useless.
He did great art as well too. He did great flyer art such too. Great guy. He passed away. He was actually a Charlie Chaplin. He was the number one Charlie Chaplin impersonator in the world in Switzerland. And he was based out of Switzerland.
What? Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy, wild. It goes to show like the interesting people that kind of came out of this punk scene or that were drawn to it and then found like other creative places to go, be it Chaplin impersonator or.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people grew up to be movie directors and producers and famous artists and famous musicians, even, a lot of people grew up and took it to the next level, you know, took their hobbies to the career level, you know, which is amazing that you can have such a following to the point where you can make a living and then some. That's commendable.
Well, I find it also interesting doing this podcast, how it stays with people. Like, you talk to Fred Armisen about this stuff and it's still like he carries with, that's what's like a religion, right? Because it's something that even if you leave it, it's like Catholic guilt afterwards. Like you still think about this thing and the morals and ethics. Yeah.
I was raised Catholic. So I know about that guilt, but
yeah,
he can always go to confession and talk to Vinny Stegman and be forgiven. Vinny's birthday yesterday. So happy birthday, Vinny. I think happy he's 95 birthday. Now.
Yeah,
he's got to be 77.
Did you ever see his band like that? Because he had a punk capital P kind of punk band first, right?
Yeah, the Eliminators.
Yeah, did you ever see the Eliminators?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. What were they?
Yeah, a bunch of times. But yeah, he had like the spiky pompadour thing going, and he had these stickers like Stigma Kills. And back then, the punk scene, not really had many tattoos. He was the first guy with a lot of tattoos. So he definitely influenced, he influenced the tattoo thing, I believe, on the New York hardcore scene, which if anything, it's amazing that Vinny Stigma was an influence, and he still is very influential. And his positive energy and his funny way of going through life is we can learn a lot from Vinny Stigma, the stigmaisms.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's just, first time I met him, you know, he was like a legend and just, he gave me a hug And I'm like, and then say first time I met you, I got a hug too. And it was just like, we had played together. So it was, but I was just like a fan going up to Vinny saying, introducing myself, and he gave me a hug. And it was just like, wow, this is so like, where else but punk could you meet a legend and then just give you a hug? Hello. You know, like, I don't think.
That's a good way of starting things with a hug. Yeah. Nobody wants to punch you after you hug them.
No, exactly. Just like, but I don't know. There's just like, what a special place that this thing was. Like, and you always hear stories about how like, interactions with that first wave of punk people, Johnny Thunders, you know, people had legendarily poor interactions with Johnny Thunders. Did you find that when you were first getting into it with the older generation?
Johnny Thunders was a junkie. So he was, I saw him play at Irving Plaza and he didn't even know he was on stage and stepped forward, unplugged his guitar. It was a sloppy mess. Hmm. And I'd been a sloppy mess on stage before, being intoxicated and dumb. But you know, that's part of the illness, not part of the solution that we get from our scene. Also I had a bad interaction with Johnny Ramone when I was on tour with him. But, you know, that's negative stuff. There was so much more positive stuff that I got out of the scene. But that's people being egos and addicts don't make the best friends.
Yeah, well, no, and I only bring it up because I find – like that stuff can also be just as informative as the good interactions on how you go forward as a person in a band.
Yeah, but you learn how not to be.
Exactly.
You don't, you know, once you're disappointed in meeting someone, you don't want to be that person. Mm-hmm. And so if anything, you learn from other people's mistakes and you learn from other people's behavior, how not to be or how to be. And, meeting Charlie Harper, stayed in my house. You can't stay in my house. Wow. You know, it's like, the great guys, and they're my friends to this day, you know.
Yeah.
Johnny, bad taste, didn't have to behave the way he behaved when I was on tour. I'm not going to get into it, but he was just really out of his way to be a douche. And whatever, I still made peace with him at his grave when my friend Howie Pyro passed away, and they buried him not too far from Johnny's spot. So I put my hand on Johnny's thing. I was like, we're good. As I walked away, he still laid there. So, I mean, I made peace with him. I made peace with myself by not hating on the guy after burying my friend right there. But Hollywood forever, if you ever go, if you're ever in Hollywood, that's where Howie Pyro is. It's where Mickey Rooney is, Toto the Dog, Johnny's there, Dee Dee's there. A lot of famous people buried there, but it's a pretty amazing cemetery if that's your bit.
Yeah.
I just came back from Argentina and I went to Evita Perón's grave, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
In Argentina, really creepy graveyard.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fun when you're on tour. Well, when you're on tour, you got to go like, you got to stay busy in those downtimes between when you're on stage and keep your mind occupied and like taking in the history of a place.
Lately, I haven't had downtime. Unfortunately, I was thinking about it and we don't really get many days off. And now when I do get a day off, I just fucking stay in bed or I jump in the pool if there's a pool and try to recharge my batteries, dude. Cause it's like, I'm not running and John Joseph gets up at like fucking 5 a.m. on tour and goes running. I'm leaving the bar at 5 a.m. and running to go to sleep for a little bit. But yeah, two different parts of the spectrum. But
well, I've watched you eat buffalo wings on stage, so I think it's different lifestyle choices at that point too.
Yeah, I can't do the buffalo wing on stage anymore, but I will eat a slice of pizza anywhere though.
I think I lucked out with Johnny, and I met Johnny one time. I went out for dinner with him because a teacher in my high school was friends with him and through poster trading and had a really good interaction with him. But he's legendarily comes up on this podcast as someone that people had bad interactions with. And it's just as much as I guess some people can have bad days, some people can have good days. And I feel like I lucked out with him on my one day that I went over dinner.
He had a lot of bad days.
A lot of bad days. A lot of people have a lot of bad stories.
Joey was a saint, though. Joey should be a saint. Joey was the best. Joey came to my house for barbecues, hung out with my dad in Queens. Dick Manitoba and my dad and Joey Ramone on 4th of July on my back patio in Long Island City, Queens. And I was like, it's just surreal. My dad's talking shit with Joey Ramone and Dick Manitoba. Pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
I wish I had a picture. I don't know how to fucking picture it because that's when you didn't have pictures on these things. They had actual picture. I don't want the picture.
Oh my gosh, that would be amazing. Yeah, because that's like I think the Dictators are another group that
The Dictators were ahead of their time. I mean, their shit's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, whatever that means.
They played the show that Kiss got signed at.
A lot,
There was a lot of dead people stuff in that place, but but I mean, Richard's been my friend for a long time. Another person, you know, I know since I'm a kid that treated me right. You know, it's sad. People are getting older and people are kicking off, dude. You know,
unfortunately, Charlie Harper's about to be 80 years old from the UK subs.
And still, like the legend, like we played with them in Winnipeg 10 years ago, and it was just they were cool as shit, like just like the nicest
Nice
dudes.
guy. Have a
Yeah,
beer with you, relax, talk shit.
yeah,
And they get up and sing. 8 years old. Yeah, Lux
yeah,
Interior too. Rest
yeah.
his soul. Lux Interior from the Cramps was like 70, 75 or 70 something before he passed, unfortunately.
Did
They're
you
way
ever
too
see
early,
them
I
at?
think, too.
Did you see them at Max's when they played?
No, I saw them at Limelight. I saw them at the Ritz. I actually did security for them and drove them around when they did Limelight, which was pretty crazy. I just got a new van, which is a rarity in my life. And Lux Interior and Ivy, I picked them up from the airport, and they were sitting right behind me in the van. And I'm looking in my rearview mirror, and I'm like, "There's Lux had that weird oblong like Doyle head.
Yeah.
They look he looks like a monster without monster makeup on." And there's Ivy, and I'm looking. I almost crashed the van like 20 times. Just stared at them like, "I can't believe Ivy and Lux are sitting behind me in my van." And they were like the most normal behaving people, but the weirdest looking people ever. It was like literally having the Addams family sit behind me, the real ones.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they were so nice and so soft-spoken and sweet. Ivy was great, and I feel bad for her being alone because that was just Lux was her soulmate for sure.
Yeah, they feel like one of the great love stories to kind of come out of this music, or when you look at this music with a lot of
Yeah.
like terrible stories and with love, that's like one of the great.
Yeah, like Sid and Nancy didn't work out too good.
No, that definitely that was the one I was definitely thinking of in my
Yeah,
head, and it's
that one didn't work out too good.
no. Did you see Sid Vicious do that solo show stuff when he was in New York with Pure Hell?
No, that was just before my time.
Okay, so like by the time you start going to shows, is there it's like the stimulators, it feels like that was kind of like the changeover generation, like student teacher
Yeah,
stimulators.
that was the transition period. When the stimulators started playing and we started moving the tables out of the area, the pit area at Max's and started skanking. And then the Dead Kennedys came to town and then we started beating the shit out of each other, slam dancing. Yeah, it was that evolution. I was part of a really cool part of the whole evolution into what is now hardcore punk, or now called hardcore.
Do you remember like what were the bands that kind of brought that about, like when the slamming started happening? Like obviously the Dead Kennedys show you said, but was it like were there local bands? Because there's always that there's that I think it's in America's Hardcore, Henry Rollins talks about them going out to the West Coast, seeing moshing, seeing slamming, bringing that back to DC, and then kind of spreading it around by showing up at shows and beating up on kids.
Shows and punching us and us punching them back.
Yeah,
Uh,
yeah.
yeah, it's like they went to California, and then California came to us, and then they came to us, and then we all knocked each other around while music played, and it turned into a bit of a thing. But it was like when I saw Jello Biafra, who I still to this day can't believe he's not the singer of the Dead Kennedys anymore. But to me, he is the singer of the Dead Kennedys, and whatever the Dead Kennedys are. Not the Dead Kennedys. That's just me being a singer. And they played at Bond's Casino at Times Square where the Clash played like a week. And they played, and I saw him on stage and perform, and it was like, and then I saw them at I believe Irving Plaza, and he was just doing his bit. And guys from DC came up and they were doing their bit, and it was contagious. We stopped, you know, we were just skanking in place, and then it just turned into like a fucking free for all. And It evolved into this pretty big, crazy thing that we do now.
Is that stuff with Boston and the beef between the two kind of overblown? Because there's that photo of you moshing for SSD.
I was always friends with all those. I'm friends. I try to be friends with everybody, but of course, there was the competitive edge between the three cities. But then, you know, people that carry beefs, like I said, are ignorant and don't have many friends. I like to be friends with people, so I made friends with Choke and Chris Daugherty and all the guys in Boston many years ago, as well as Ian and everybody in DC. You know, it's like you know, we're not going to get anywhere not getting along. We all got pretty far getting along. So, yeah, that's, once again, heroes became my friends, and all our bands played together and grew together, you know, as friends and as musicians.
Well, yeah, because you guys are covering Void in that Psychos video. Like, so there's obviously like a DC love then too.
Well, when you're a kid and you smoke angel dust, you definitely like Void. Like weed is the Grateful Dead, dust is Void. Yeah, I can't even believe I can carry on a sentence anymore with all the things I've done.
Oh my god, the dust thing though was huge in New York hardcore at that time, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Nothing to be proud of, but I don't think anyone died from it like the heroin. But yeah, definitely the aggressive form of the music and the aggressive reaction to that drug definitely was a catalyst to many powerful mosh pits, to put it politely. Yeah.
It's interesting how that drug and like Quaaludes obviously too are just like don't exist anymore.
Oh, those are great. I miss those. Those are like old guys' addicts.
The Ludes are the one that's got to come back.
No, they won't come back. But methaqualone was the actual drug, the compound methaqualone, which was Quaaludes, and that was made by Roar and Lemon. Lemon 714 was the pill, and it made you very, very mellow and goofy. I think they were the ones that they called goofballs. And that was back then. We had the best. To talk drugs. Back then, we had the best drugs. There was no fentanyl and everything. What you got is what you got, and usually, what you got was really good. So,
well, and I guess the other stuff that people are doing around then is like, especially on the Lower East Side, is heroin, right? The people lower the buckets down from
a lot of heroin. It fucked up a lot of people. A lot of kids on our scene died from it. I fortunately never got into it. I like to go up, not down. Yeah. And
that's a thing that's tragically kind of universal about punk too. Is the heroin is something that always seems to show up, and it could be in Vancouver. It could be even in Toronto. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately now just a micro dot, a dust particle of this fentanyl can kill somebody immediately, which is horrible. And it seems that people are getting off on getting it out there. But yeah, I mean, if you look at up Lemmy, Motorhead, down Johnny Thunders, junky shit, boring. Kurt Cobain, heroin. Dead. Lemmy lived a pretty long life for being awake for fucking 40 years.
Yeah, it's a good argument for why to do speed, I guess. I don't know if I can really say that, but.
Or you could go the route of Ian McKay and just be nice to everybody and sell records.
I think
Ian's got it going the best.
He definitely. I was going to ask you, were you there that night of the Fear Saturday Night Live thing when his name was like the password and stuff?
Yeah, I was. I didn't get it. I was there and went with my girlfriend Sherry to go get a quart of beer, and everyone got in on these. We had these standby tickets, and Quaaludes, once again, a bunch of people got in through a freight elevator and a bunch of Quaaludes I had, and I went to go get a beer with my girl. Everybody got up, and I was in a fire command station banging her under the under the stage while everyone was going nuts there, and then we all went downtown. I get to remember this. I went downtown and I had an egg for like a month to throw at somebody because of Halloween. So I had this month old egg, and I remember I was with all the guys from DC, and we were going downtown to A7, just out the train, and a girl walked by in this big rock lobster outfit, and everyone was like, "Jimmy, you know, what the egg?" And I was like, "Man, I can't do that. Man. Come on, hit her with the egg. Fuck that rock lobster shit." And I threw the egg and I hit the girl with the lost outfit with the egg, and I still feel bad. 43 years later, I still feel bad about throwing an egg at a girl in a big foam costume. But yeah, I was. When you're a little punk rock kid and the older punk rock kids are telling you to do something dumb, you do it.
It's those no good DC kids again.
Well, there was a set of kids that weren't straight edge in DC, and that's when we were wearing spurs and shit, copying the guys from California. I think it was a guy named Jake. It was Jake. It was Chick Lefty. She was crazy. Skinhead girl. There was a lot of crazy
She's a
people.
Very famous Lefty the Skin. She's a very famous person in DC hardcore.
Yep. Lefty was still a good friend of mine. I don't see her anymore, but yeah,
Wow.
tough person.
That's the legends. That's definitely there's not
Yes,
about how
she's groomed many a skinhead boy.
Yeah. Wow, that's wild. That's a I guess that's the other thing is that night is so storied in hardcore kind of annals now, but it's just like a handful of you could probably even think of everyone that was there if you had enough time
Yeah,
because
Jesse, you can see Jesse Malin on stage there, jump off the stage. Ian's there, and they're all yelling "fuck New York" and all, typical shit.
John Brandon's there too, right?
They were every yeah, like the whole scene from D.C. and New York are pretty much there
Yeah.
that got in. It's funny. D.C. could talk shit, but it was being filmed in New York, not in D.C. They came to us.
Did you ever meet John Belushi?
I'm still no. I didn't meet John Belushi. Never met him.
Because he would hang out
He
at
that was
CB's.
once again. I was a little. He would hang out at CB's, and he was hanging out with the Dead Boys. There's pictures of him with. I think he played with the Dead Boys once. It was him.
Yeah.
That was once again a little bit before my time because I was still in the midst of going out, getting punished. So that was he was with the older kids. I wasn't out hanging out with those are older, fancier people than me. Being a kid with a dollar in my pocket, not being hardly get, being able to get into the club, let alone hang out with those people.
What's the story with you with a chainsaw on stage? I've heard a legend of you coming on
Yeah.
stage with a chainsaw.
Somebody had a chainsaw. Everybody come in from Jersey and Long Island and whatnot, and borrow their dad's trucks and shit. Somebody I think it might have been Petey Hines who played in Murphy's Law and Cro-Mags. I think he had a chainsaw in his dad's truck that he drove down to the show. And I took the chainsaw in, and we were going on, and I had the chainsaw backstage. I literally cut up slicing the wall, and man, I don't know how the fuck I did it, and pretty dumb thing to do, but I did it. Pushed through the crowd with the chainsaw running, and got on stage and fully cranked the chainsaw, and then shut it off with all the smoke coming out of it. And then we started the set, and the place went fucking nuts. I'm just glad I had the sense not to just start cutting shit up on stage and doing a Wendy O. Williams bit, but yeah, I used it as an instrument, but and it worked. But yeah,
The industrial side of Murphy's Law.
that was my industrial phase. It only lasted a moment.
It's awesome. What are your memories of the Donahue show?
I remember I made them send a limo for me and Natalie.
That's awesome.
And I was at my parents' house in Queens, and where I'm at now, down the block. And we were in the limo, and we banged all the way to 30 Rock, and then we got to 30. You know when they have the fucking tree for Christmas,
Yeah.
in Rockefeller Plaza, right there is where it was filmed. Like we're in the heart of New York City, and we're in a green room, and the guy who wrote the book. No, not the book. It was like an article. Peter Blauner, never forget his name. He turned out to be like one of these people. When the music was getting popular and getting attention, we were on all these fucking shows. And I was in. I think it was New York Magazine cover article in New York Magazine, and it was like the guy came to us. And usually we were very rough with people that wanted to photograph us or interview us that were out of our scene, not from a fanzine. And this guy gained our trust. Talked how he was so interested in our music scene, and basically when he was d finally done doing his write-up and it was already out, made it like this soap opera with me and some girl that I was like a fan of the band, and didn't make her look good, didn't make me look. It made it like this groupie story thing, and had nothing to do with our music scene.
Yeah.
So it was very disappointing, and we were very hateful towards this guy because he disappointed us. Go figure, the media disappointed us. And they got him on stage with us, and he didn't get a good reception. Neither did Phil, because they had us basically. It was like a horseshoe of the regular aspect of society, moms and dads and aunts, like regular people, and
Yep.
then us in the middle. So they
Yeah.
kind of had a certain. Then they planned it like that, and they tried to get this big fucking confrontational thing. Excuse my language. Out of us, and in turn, it blew up in his fucking face, because while sitting down, you're sitting when you're filming the stuff, you're sitting waiting all the time. Everyone was making friends with everyone. So all the people that he thought was going to hate us turned out loving us. And when it finally went to light and he was on his thing trying to instigate, no one would jump on it because everyone already made friends with everybody. And then Natalie up there, who was very well educated and a really smart, at the time not a woman yet, a really smart girl, just took him apart. And you know, a couple of our friends were silly, like my friend Alexa, but but it was part of it. But for the most part, I remember an old lady getting up. I was just talking to this young man about what's on his jacket, and it was so nice. And it was just killing Phil Donahue that this lady was like, "This is disgusting." No, she was like, "I really like the guy." And the guy's like, "Thank you, lady." It was like totally opposite of what this guy wanted. And between commercials, they would be like, "No, I argue with Phil." I'm like, "Don't." And I literally told, finally, they were really pushing it. And I finally told this this woman that was fucking busting balls. I was like, "Stop fucking busting my balls and telling me what to do. We're going to do what we want to do, not what you tell us." And they were trying to make it like, "I'm the leader of this skinhead thing." And I'm like, and I do remember part of what I said. It was like, "There are no leaders in this. We are all together." And I know there was a lot of good points coming from angles, and he hated it. I think he was the only one that did hate it, because we were left shaking hands with everybody that was supposed to be our enemy and our and not understand what we're about. And it worked out. And then after the show, Phil comes back, and I had nothing to say, and Natalie fucking tore him a new asshole, because he came back like saying something, and like he wasn't happy the way it went, and we were because we won, and she said something to him, man, and it fucking burned him, and he went off, and they had to escort him out of the green room. And I was hysterical. I was like, "Fuck, bro, take care, later." We destroyed him. We won. It was great.
Well, like, if this is a religion, that would be one of the books in the Bible, because every kid watched that video. Like, it was traded around and sent around and just like dissected, and you'd see who you could see in the crowd and see who you could name. And it just became, it was just like one
Everybody
of the all-time
was there. I was honored. Oh. I was honored to be up front and be part of it. And I hope I didn't let anybody down. I tried my best.
Oh, you're awesome, man.
As good as I was back then.
And now I know that you've been having sex the whole time. That explains your cool vibe, chilled out vibe on stage.
Banged all the way there and got the limo and banged all the way back to Queens. We were having fun. It was great. And I closed the window on the limo and it just went to town. We were like,
it is like,
it was great.
Oh, it's awesome. It's like, it's such a incredible document of that time period too. And like, it also shows the difference between, because you can tell that what they wanted is what they would get later on from when you'd see the mentors on Springer or Gigi Allen on Geraldo, you know, where you get these kind of like circus shit where it's not like a family.
They weren't getting a circus from us. They were getting a family of kids that we were all very close to each other, and very all different beliefs, all different forms of ways of life, from all different lifestyles, but all there for one purpose. And that was to support our scene.
Well, I find that's the thing that's fascinating about New York, because New York is able to hold so many contradictions at the same time. Like, you have Nausea playing with YDL. Like, it's just like there's just so much like shit that's contained in New York that just does not seem like it would exist. Like, the graffiti stuff happening at the same time that the skinhead stuff is happening, and how they're weirdly part of each other's history is just so fascinating. Like, just New York is such a cultural study in punk.
Well, DMS, Doc Martin Skins, started as a graffiti crew.
Yeah.
And still pretty much is. So, you know, it's skinhead, like, graffiti rider. There you go.
Well,
of all race, creeds, and colors, too. Much to my chagrin, I have severe tinnitus right now. I'm losing my hearing.
Oh, sorry to
hear that. And I have a fractured spine and all this other shit. So, I lately don't even stay. I get in time to get on, and I get out, because otherwise I can't. I lose my voice. I lose my hearing. I lose my voice from yelling so much over trying to be able to hear what I'm saying. I, man, I, it's getting tough to do shows like I used to do them. So,
I think there's a lack of appreciation on the physical toll that this kind of music takes on people.
Yeah, well, I don't jump off the balconies anymore, but it's I still jump off. I'm still jumping off the stage like an idiot. I don't like to be on stage really anymore. I like to be in the crowd. Much my band's dismay. The last run we just did with the Rum Jacks and the Barstool Preachers and Code Two, or Grade Two. I keep fucking up with their name on. We were playing these clubs that really weren't for us. They were these big clubs with barricades, and I would literally the band would do the intro, we'd set our levels, and then I'd step off over the barricade and just play in the crowd.
Yeah, that's how I
I don't.
did
Yeah, we did the fest in with the big fucking fest in England. I couldn't be on the stages. Punk music's not made for these big stages, and my upbringing on it hasn't changed my mind on being part of the crowd and being down with the crowd. I don't think barricades or big stages have anything to do with what our community is about.
I would like when we went on tour with the Foo Fighters, and I would just wander the stadium the whole time we were playing, like just like wander amongst all the people with like as they're trying to find their seats.
We did the thing with the Beastie Boys, and that was I wasn't on stage much for that either. I was, but then there was no pit; it was just chairs, and I would dive off the stage into the chairs and get beat up and thrown out matches.
That's like pre-Lollapalooza. Like Public Enemy, yourselves and Beastie Boys all going out together, like pre-alternative
Fishbone
music
too.
happening. Fishbone was on that too. That's what a lineup.
Fishbone started on. Fishbone was on the majority of the tour. Public Enemy stepped in when Fishbone went to film Back to the Beach with Annette Funicello.
Yeah. Aren't the Cramps in that too? Or no?
No.
Or maybe they're.
And Back to the Beach, maybe. I haven't seen it
Say
in years. Now I got to watch it tonight.
yeah, now me too. You've inspired me to for what I'm going to see after this.
Public Enemy stepped in though, and actually opened for us.
That would be such an interesting tour when you're hitting places like obviously I'm sure like New York and Los Angeles are fine, but like you're playing all over the place. Like there must have been some weird shows for you guys to kind of go out there and do your thing.
Playing big arenas. We started playing clubs, and then license sale broke, and then we went from like we were playing. Well, that's back when colleges had bars and clubs, and we played the colleges, and it was nuts. And then we went to arenas, which was that was crazy. Played the Hollywood Palladium, dude. Like 17, I played the Hollywood Palladium in a tour bus. The Beastie Boys got me a tour bus.
It must have been, yeah, like very, like especially trying to like go from playing, a CB show or even a Rich show or like a bigger show where you've got like, you can kind of see all the crowd and you can kind of control the audience. So being in a thing like that where it's not even about controlling the audience, it's a hostile audience in some cases.
Dude, it was like it was. I only had 15 minutes, but it was like, holy shit! How much trouble can I get in 15 minutes? And no matter what, the Beastie Boys took our back. No matter how much dumb shit I did and got in trouble, I do remember them even canceling, not canceling some of the shows. I got in trouble, and they were like, Murphy's Law can't play. And then they were like, then we're not playing. And literally, can't. I do recall them
Wow.
canceling like, at least the two shows
That's
because
awesome.
we were doing our bit. I was diving off the stage into chairs. The bouncers beat me up, and it was on. And then the next day, the word would get out, and the next promoter wouldn't want us to play. And they were like, "Then we're not playing either." They were the best to us. They took such good care of the band. Really great guys.
Well, it feels like they also, never lost that connection to hardcore, right? Like, didn't Ad Rock fill in for bass with the Cro-Mags for one show or something? Like,
And then, well, then they, when we were on that tour with them, they would do this before Public Enemy stepped in. And when Fishbone was out, there was a little, couple days where they came up and would dress in like clown outfits or some shit. And they were doing this band Trip Hammer. It was like their version of Spinal Tap. So before we would go on, they would come out dressed different, not, you didn't even know it was them, and do this like corny, fun punk band, Trip Hammer. And nobody knew it. We'd jump out and do our dumb shit, and then they'd come out and do their bit. It was
that's
fucking, it was so much fun, unbelievably.
But that was like, you guys had already tried to tour America by that point too, right? Because you toured before the album, like on the demo.
Yeah, we toured. Yeah, in living six guys in a van, sleeping all together in a cargo van. and Petey Hines at the time, who later joined the Cro-Mags, got mononucleosis. So we were on our way to get to California and play the Olympic Auditorium with the Bad Brains and Dead Kennedys and all these crazy shows. And this fucking guy gets mono halfway across the country. And
holy shit.
Now we'd put him on a bus and send him home and grab any kid at the next show.
Yeah.
We came home and then he bailed on us to go join the Cro-Mags.
Damn.
To go on, if I may recall, he left to go on to bigger and better things. And then like a month later, we got the Beastie Boys tour. Yeah, buddy.
What was the, like after the Beastie Boys tour, was there like a lot of like label interest and sort of like excitement around the band, or was it?
Yeah, there was a ton of shit and I fell for a lot of it. And now I'm still regretting it. We did that shit with Profile Records, who mm-hmm. just released our first record again without our knowledge and without our permission or our input.
Really? And, that's not official, that thing that came out.
No, that's not official release. That's not sanctioned by the band. Completely against us. And I let a lot of record labels know, a lot of record stores know. The record label put it out. I mean, they could have spoke to me about it and maybe we could have remastered some stuff, added some stuff. They just, it's a money grab because there's revision of copyright. And let's get crazy now in America, which after a ridiculous amount of time for a record label to cash in on the artist, the artist has a very small window of opportunity to regain their copyrights, to their music, and there's like two more years before revision comes in for me, and this is their quick money grab again to make more money on the band and not pay the band anything. They haven't paid the band anything in over 30 plus years.
And how is that not recouped like at least several times over at this point?
It has. They only, yeah. The first pressing was 30,000 on the Beastie Boys. We sold them all.
Yeah.
And they did nothing to forward the band's career. They only did enough to recoup their costs and make their profit without re-releasing stuff, pushing stuff. There was no, on that whole tour, there was no posters. There was no promote. There was zero promotion. We were just doing it all on our own leg. Mm. And, a lot of people could say, I know Harley's complained about it and tried to sue the label and stuff. I'm not looking to blow money and waste time like that. Because we did sign contracts when we were kids, not knowing anything. And you're 17 years old and a label wants to put your record out. All right, yeah, DIY. I didn't have any fucking money to buy a slice of pizza, never mind to put my own record out. Bands that put their own records out had probably better jobs and supportive parents. We didn't have that. So when this opportunity knocked, we saw it as a generous thing. And being naive and young and dumb, we trusted people. And the label got us our own lawyer. Go figure that. You get the lawyer from the label, which we were fucking doomed right there, dude. So we signed shit that fucked us.
That's the thing Jerry A brought up when he was on the show. Like, the only reason Poison Idea was able to kind of put out records is because Pig Champion had a dubious but had income coming in at that time. And like, you need money to do this shit. Like you were saying earlier, this shit's not done for free. And like, if someone's going to pay for it, that's going to be the way it comes out. But I think it was actually Daryl Jennifer talked about when he's on the show, just like what the Bad Brains had to do to get records out and get their music out there, because they gave up a lot of stuff in terms of rights and in terms of ownership of different recordings, because it was just about trying to get the music out at any cost.
Yeah. A lot of people ask what Murphy's Law not putting out more records. It's like, I see the band as a live band. I never consider myself a musician. I'm more of an entertainer. I'm not a writer.
The recordings are great though. Like you're downplaying the recordings. They're always, when you do put out a record, they're always fucking great.
I have been blessed to be in great studios with great producers. And the producer is the person that makes the music happen, really. Mm. If you listen to the Germs GI record and then you listen to the Germs live, it's like, wow, that record is amazing. And I do believe Joan Jett was the producer of that record.
No, she, according to what people have told in the podcast, she was not as heavily involved in that record. The Bikini Kill record, she was very involved in, but like, I think Joan was at a rougher patch when she was doing that Germs record, according to what has been told on this podcast.
We were just lucky to be in the studios. I was in some amazing analog studios with really great producers. So if anything, through the influence of the label, to give them any fucking credit, which they hooked me up with the right people to record with. And that's just smart for their investment to make sure that the product that they're going to put out is sellable. But once we were selling them, they didn't support the band or help the band grow, which is where I don't like. And now years later down the line, they're still putting their hands in my pocket and not paying it back. They've already profited from the band. They put the record out. I haven't seen a dime. So, I mean, it's not all about money, but it is all about money when a fucking company is robbing you. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah. If it's not all about money, but if someone's making money, the people that made the product should get compensated in some way.
Yeah, there were supposed to be quarterly reports on sales, never received anything. They still haven't reported anything, and they just put the record out now. But do I want to get my lawyer now and throw money at my lawyer to go after these people for a contract that they can't even find? How do you say you own something? Like, if I get pulled over with my car, I have to show registration or a title. They say they still have a contract. Where's the contract? They're not producing it. But now to get them to prove that, I need to pay a lawyer. To get them at the court, I need to pay a lawyer. And then this is time, and time is money when it comes to a lawsuit. So I'd rather just sit on my hands and then get my revision rights and move forward. You know, but unfortunately, they're going to fucking, you know, they're pushing the record out again. I mean, I put the record out years ago with Ice Cream Records, where we put the whole back catalog out of all of four records or five records, and just to say fuck you to them, and they didn't say anything. Because then that proved to me that they didn't have anything to prove that they had the rights to the record. So now it's hard. I'm still up in the air what to do right now, but I still have about a year and a half to get my revision back, so I'm going to focus that, not my attention on that, to actually own the rights.
You put out the demo on vinyl a couple years ago, though, right? Or a few years ago now?
The demo came out in Japan on vinyl. I'm looking to do that again.
Yeah, definitely put that out.
We did a cover record of, you know, everybody was asking us to do a song on this, do a song on that. So we would do a cover song. And then I compiled so many cover songs that I made a record, a cover record called Covered, with a Waffle House theme. So it was like scattered, smothered, covered.
That's awesome.
And it looked like, it didn't say a Waffle House, it said Murphy's Law. And the CD was an actual waffle. And we were printing them at my desk. I had an older computer that had the two decks in it. So we were just printing our own labels and our own CD. Do it DIY. We had our own printing press going of CDs. But now I think I'm going to try to put that out on vinyl, because it's never been out on vinyl.
Well, and that demo is so awesome too. Like that demo, like, you know, you're saying it's a live band, and obviously I saw you guys later on, but the songs on that demo are raging.
Well, for being 17 at the time, yeah, pretty funny that we could even put songs together. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. But like, you look at all this stuff now, like, people still, Minor Threat just put out the outtakes from Out of Step the other week, or like, yeah, Ian just put those out, right? Like, the stuff that was being made by these teenagers back then still has impact, you know, 40 plus
years. Dude, you listen to Bubba Dupree's guitar work on Void, dude.
It's like, crazy. The greatest. Kid. It's great. Yeah.
Ryan Baker's stuff, dude. We were fucking 16, 17-year-old kids putting out records. I mean, even though it was 500 of them, but who'd have thunk it that putting out 500 records, now these records are worth $5,000 each, or $10,000 you go to the Misfits.
Yeah.
First of all, we're going to spend that much money on a fucking piece of plastic. I mean, download the music and feed the homeless. That's what but I mean, to own a 7-inch to spend $10,000, I can't imagine.
My friend sold a Fixed Vengeance for $10,000 cash. On, like, just straight up, the guy flew in, met the guy at the airport, gave the guy the record, he got handed the money, and the guy flew out that night. Like,
a vinyl drug deal.
It's crazy. Like, just like, unbelievable that, like, handfuls of kids, but then you look at who's in these handfuls of kids. Like you brought up Rick Rubin, and obviously, you know, he's in Hose, and Hose is playing with Vatting Commandos with Moby.
I sang a show with Hose. I played for a minute in Hose.
What?
Yeah, I did. Going to the zoo, going to the zoo. I said before I was far the entertainer that I am now. I was very insecure on stage, but I played on stage at CBGB's with Hose. Yeah,
that's awesome. Wow, yeah. I love those Hose records too. Like that's like I love that New York noise rock sound too.
Only the astronaut knows the truth. I think one of the songs is or something. Yeah, Rick and I were good friends when he was in college. He was a great friend to me, a good guy. And now he's like a monk.
Yeah.
If you see the stuff, I don't know where the fuck he's been or what mountain he's been on, but he's coming down and he's talking some really positive spiritual shit.
Yeah.
I'd be rolling around naked in $100 bills if I was him.
I would have the best weed, I'll tell you that much.
I'd be covered in guacamole, but puppies licking it off me, fucking filming it. At the end of fucking 24-karat gold on Davidson, I'd fully pimp it out.
I got to say, Jimmy, this has been unbelievable. And anytime you want to come on this show and talk about any of this stuff, you know the door is always open.
Yeah, man, just reach out. Next, we leave Friday to go out for 2 weeks with Agnostic Front. And then New Year's Eve is the 40th anniversary. We play in Brooklyn at the Kingsland. And then after that, I really don't know what I'm doing. I'm going to try to take a break for a little bit, I think, and try to write some shit, maybe. Because we have a bunch of stuff recorded already for a new record. It's just not complete yet. And I really want to – I actually have the record cover. So the record cover is done. So there is a record coming out. Because usually the record's done and there's no cover. But now this is motivating me and pushing me to finish this thing up.
I know many an Edgeman that's broken edge in a Murphy's Law pit. So, you know, I think you've medicated a whole generation.
Don't break edge over me.
Thank you, Jimmy, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Jimmy will be back for a part two at some point in the future. And once again, Kingsland at New Year's Eve. You better go out there and check out in Brooklyn, New York, and check out Murphy's Law for their 40th anniversary show. A milestone for one of the greatest bands to ever do it. And that will do it for this week's episode. Coming up on the next episode of Turned at a Punk, we're just going to go from strength to strength, from Pulling Teeth, from one of my favorite bands to put it on LP last year, N Rain, from Day of Mourning, from Integrity, from Dirge. Dominic Romeo is going to be on the show. And believe me, this is a good one. This is awesome. If you know Dom just from his current life as a American hardcore mover and shaker running the incredible A389 Records, you only know half the story. Because to me, It's Dom, who I met in the pit just before Sick of It All played in Toronto at Club Shanghai. And we go deep. We go way back and we talk about a lot of stuff. This is a fantastic episode. I'm excited for you to hear it. And that is it for this show this week. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different races, because we're not talking about politics here. This is just basic human rights shit. People deserve to live free from hate and violence and discrimination. So if there's organizations in your community that are affecting positive change, I'm sure they could benefit from your volunteering, your time, if you have time, or, you know, financial support, if you have financial support, because it'll feel better if you start affecting the change you want to see in this world. Speaking about affecting the change you want to see, you can do that in punk. You can start a band, start a fanzine. Hell, you could start a whole scene. You could invent a style of moshing with your friends that people are doing 40 years later all over the world. You know, like anyone can do this shit. So do it. Speaking of doing things, sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. They're literally dead weight, and like you just get them out of your body, and they can perform miracles with that. I've seen it happen. And try meditating. What's the worst that can happen? Maybe it works for you. Maybe it doesn't. It takes a couple tries, though. I promise you, from my experience. And hell, don't take my word for it. There's people that do this shit that are way more successful than I do. I am. And they do it a lot more consistently, probably, too. All right. It's been a long holiday weekend. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.